Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, August 31st, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss West Virginia versus EPA, the case about the Clean Power Plan. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're extremely pleased to have repeat return guest, Mr. Albert Lynn. He's the Solicitor General in the state of West Virginia, and he'll be arguing the case, at least in part. He's going to walk us through the case with a series of questions that I'm going to pose back and forth. We'll have a bit of a conversation, but as is our habit, we'll be getting to the audience for questions, so please be thinking of those questions probably at the 20, 30, or 40-minute mark of our call here today. Albert Lynn, good afternoon, and thank you for joining us. I wonder if you could just get us started by giving us an update on where the case is procedurally and how we got to where we are today.
Great. Thanks, Dean. So just as Dean mentioned, let me just start with a full disclosure that I am counsel for the state of West Virginia in the case, and so I'm counsel for one of the petitioners and will be one of the advocates at oral argument on behalf of the 20-plus states that are involved in the case. So I may be somewhat circumspect today in what I say. I will largely confine my remarks to things that are already in the public domain. But what I view this as is hopefully I will at least save anyone who's listening the trouble of having to read through hundreds and hundreds of pages of briefing. So procedurally, as most people probably know who have paid attention to this case, the rule was challenged in October of last year, as soon as it was published in the Federal Register by a large group of states, industry, and private organizations. There was briefing and fight over whether to stay the rule at the D.C. Circuit. It was ultimately stayed by the Supreme Court by 5-4 vote in early February of 2016, shortly before Justice Scalia's passing. There are a lot of interesting ancillary issues related to the stay and its effect that will come up at oral argument. I won't talk about today, but if folks are looking for an interesting law review topic, that might be one for you. The argument was originally scheduled for early June before a panel of Judges Henderson, Rogers, and Srinivasan at the D.C. Circuit. But very shortly before argument happened, as the advocates were in the midst of preparing, the full court issued an order sua sponte setting it for an en banc argument, which will happen on September 27th, next month at 9:30. Two members of the court are not participating, so there are 11 on the D.C. Circuit, but only 9 will be sitting. Judge Garland and Judge Pillard are recused from the case. The court issued an order setting the argument schedule. It's going to be in one day with a break for lunch. There will be 5 mini arguments with a total of 17 different advocates for 3 hours and 38 minutes. And so the 5 mini arguments are kind of by issue, and I'll walk through those a little bit later in this call. But procedurally, that's how we got where we are, Dean.
Okay, very good. But before we get to the heart of the legal challenges, there's a rule involved here, the Clean Power Plan rule. I'm not sure our listeners are even remotely familiar with it. Maybe you can talk about that before we get into the heart of the legal challenges.
Yeah, that makes sense. So the rule comes under Clean Air Act, Section 111, and it's sort of important because I'll use 111 as a shorthand, and it's also important to understand what the statute involves. So Section 111 allows for regulation of certain pollutants from certain sources, and it covers in separate categories existing sources in that category, and that's under Section 111D, and then new sources of the same type, and that's under Section 111B, and the difference between those provisions will become relevant later. Basically, what happens is, for one or the other, and Clean Power Plan, we're talking about existing sources under 111D, The issue is the creation of a standard of performance. And so under 111D, the EPA can promulgate emission guidelines, and then the states are to promulgate a standard of performance. And a standard of performance is it's defined as a standard of emissions of air pollutants, which reflects the degree of emission limitation achievable through the application of the best system of emission reduction. And so that's sort of the key phrase here, the best system of emission reduction. And that's something that the administrator determines has been adequately demonstrated. So what does that mean, a best system of emission reduction? Well, the EPA, at least for 111Ds, what they do is they decide what they think has been adequately demonstrated as a system of emission reduction, and then they sort of do a hypothetical application of that, and they come up with what they think is the achievable emission limitation or reduction applying that system. And so in the past, at least this is our position as the petitioners, that best system has always been a technology or a process that could be conducted at the particularly regulated facility. So easy examples, if you're thinking of a power plant with smokestacks, you know, the use of scrubbers to scrub out certain pollutants might be a system of emission reduction. Here, however, EPA has come up with something that they called generation shifting. So by that, they mean electricity generation. And so their system of emission reduction that they've considered to be the best is, you may have heard of the three building blocks, building block one, two, and three, all of which are sort of designed to come up with a level of emission reduction. And what they do is under building block one, they say power plants need to reduce their heat efficiency. So they essentially need to do what they do in a cleaner way. Coal and gas-fired steam generating units is what we're talking about. The second building block is they have a certain percentage of emission reduction that they believe to be achievable by shifting electricity generation from coal-fired power plants to natural gas-fired power plants. So actually, that's why they call it generation shifting, actually producing less electricity at a coal-fired plant and producing more at a natural gas-fired plant, which burns cleaner and therefore accounts for some percentage of emission reduction. And then building block three is some level of emission reduction that they attribute to a shift from fossil fuel-fired generation to renewable energy sources, low or zero pollutant emitting, carbon dioxide emitting energy sources. And so that's how that's their hypothetical system that they use to get an emission reduction. So they did this and they came up with a limit for ostensibly four coal generating units, but it's something that EPA admits can't be achieved by a single individual unit. It's a system of moving generation away from those particular types of sources that are being regulated. You know, before I turn to the legal issues, I'll say is there's some pretty big practical and legal consequences here for this rule. Legally, we're talking about a theory of pollution regulation that involves, that is premised on reducing performance at certain regulated facilities. And so in this particular case, you're talking about premising it on the reduction of use of fossil fuels. And that has, I think, both enormous legal and policy ramifications for what it is that EPA has within its authority and the kinds of things it can do to advance its own policy agenda.
Very good. So now, did I interrupt you, Albert?
No. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. So let's turn now to the legal issues. And I know it's a very complicated case. You've laid it out well. There are a lot of legal issues. In the briefing, the petitioners broke up the legal issues into what you've referred to before as core legal issues and then record-based issues. Can you talk about the distinction and then discuss what you mean by the core legal issues?
Sure. So we had, as Dean said, we had two briefs. Each was about 90 pages long, opening briefs, and the first was devoted to what we called core legal issues. And you know, it was a loose distinction, but core legal, I mean, the idea was that these are legal questions. They don't turn on record-based factual questions. They're legal issues that sort of go to the threshold ability of this rule to even exist. The record-based issues are ones that depend more on what EPA has shown in the record and whether they've, so might more traditionally, those who are familiar with administrative law might understand those as arbitrary and capricious type arguments. We have a lot more than that, which I'll get into later, but that was the distinction. We filed two briefs. Each was about 90 pages long. EPA replied in a single brief about 180 pages, and then, of course, we had our reply. But I'll turn to the core legal issues, and there are four in the brief, which I'll try to walk through in a systematic way so that folks who are listening can easily follow along. At the argument, these four legal issues will actually be argued in three segments, three in the first three mini-arguments that occur on September 27th. So the first of the four is whether this idea, this generation-shifting concept, is a permissible best system of emission reduction, as I was just talking about. The petitioner's view, our position is that this is something that's never happened before. We have a number of different arguments within that first category as to why it's not permissible under Section 111D. The brief advances basically two arguments within that first category. The first is that there is no clear statement from Congress permitting this theory of generation shifting. And we rely on two lines of cases. The first, there's a case called Utility Air Regulatory Group versus EPA. It came out a couple years ago from the Supreme Court. And in it, it said the Supreme Court rejected an EPA regulation, and they said in the course of rejecting that regulation that an agency cannot sort of undertake an enormous and transformative expansion in its authority without under a long extant statute, which in that case it was also the Clean Air Act, without clear congressional authorization. And so we argue that's what's going on here. This is transformative. This is enormous. It has huge consequences. By EPA's own admission, in a document that, well, not EPA, the administration, in a document that was put out the day that the rule was finalized, the administration said that the rule was an attempt to aggressively transform the domestic energy industry. We argue that this is transformative because there has never been a best system of emission reduction like this. And we argue that it's just sort of an enormous expansion of power because there's really no logical end to what they've done here. I mean, they have three building blocks where they say, you shift some, you make coal burn cleaner, you shift some coal energy generation to gas, and then you shift sort of fossil fuel energy generation over to renewables. And the limiting factor on that for the EPA right now is sort of what they claim the power sector can sustain. But under a different set of facts, one could imagine them saying that they think the power sector could sustain an even greater shift, and a greater shift that basically zeroes out the use of certain kinds of energy generation and shifts it all over to their preferred types of energy generation, which they say is cleaner. So, in our view, that's exactly the kind of transformative and enormous expansion in agency authority that requires clear congressional authorization. And we don't think there's anything in the statute that clearly permits this kind of exercise of authority. There's a second line of cases that says that you can't intrude on traditional areas of state regulation without a clear statement. And that's, it's a fairly undisputed line of cases. There's that at the Supreme Court level, it's articulated in cases like Gregory versus Ashcroft, Bond versus United States. In our briefs, we cite a D.C. Circuit case involving the American Bar Association. And so, it says there that you can't, assume that Congress wanted to upset the federal-state balance without a clear and compelling statement from Congress. And it's undisputed by either side that intrastate energy generation is traditionally a state area of regulation. We are the ones who issue the licenses for new power plants. We are the ones who make a lot of those decisions about, what our intrastate energy generation should look like. That's recognized by the Federal Power Act. That's recognized in a variety of Supreme Court cases. So the question is whether what EPA is doing with generation shifting intrudes on that. EPA says that it doesn't, and we say that it does. And we say, this necessarily intrudes on that state area of traditional state regulation in both a legal and a practical way. I mean, from a legal perspective, they are premising these emission reductions on changing the generation, the mix of electricity generation, which, as we point out, is something that is traditionally an area of state regulation. And then practically speaking, there are a lot of things that states are going to have to do in order to comply with this rule if it goes through. That will, of course, change intrastate energy generation. So again, for us, it does intrude on a traditional area of state regulation, and we don't think EPA has shown that there's clear authorization from Congress to do that. So that's the first part of the first big argument, which is that generation shifting is impermissible under Section 111B. That's the clear statement part of it. The second part of that argument, which is actually fairly large as well, is that the statute, when you read it, it's sort of decide whether or not there's a clear statement. The statute unambiguously prohibits generation shifting. And so if you read the statute, it talks about how a standard of performance, and in our view, a best system of emission reduction, has to be applicable to and has to be for an individual source. And frankly, we believe that if you look at the rule and you look at EPA's briefs, they don't contest that. They say, well, yes, of course, the best system of emission reduction has to be applicable to an individual source. And one way to sort of, but the problem is that the emission limit that they've promulgated can't be met by individual existing coal and gas-fired steam generation units. And one way to understand this is, so I referred before to how Section 111 has both a component that applies to new sources and a component that applies to existing sources. Well, on the same day that EPA promulgated a rule for existing coal and natural gas fired steam generating units, they also promulgated one for new such facilities, and there's a legal reason why they had to do that. But what I'm trying to get at is the new rule actually sets a higher level of permissible emissions. It's actually the new facilities under whatever the state of the art technology that EPA says needs to be applied to those new facilities can actually produce or permitted under this rule to generate more carbon dioxide than existing sources. So what does this mean logically? It means that you couldn't replace all existing sources with new coal-fired power plants under their own standard and meet the lower emission limit that's required of existing sources. So while EPA concedes that the BSER has to be the best system of emission reduction has to be applicable to an individual source, these can't be met by existing individual sources. So, how does the statute permit, them to come up with a system of emission reduction like this? EPA responds that, well, while it's not something that can be done by individual sources, it is something that can be done by individual sources as owners and operators by investing in, cleaner energy and by shifting some of their generation over to cleaner energy. And our response to that is owners and operators are not the same as sources. It has to be applied to the source. The term owners and operators is defined differently under the statute than is the term sources. We also have a number of other textual arguments, including the phrase standards of performance, and another part of that is that the system of emission reduction has to be a system of continuous emission reduction, and we argue that generation shifting is neither a standard of performance, it's really a standard of non-performance, nor is it a system of continuous reduction, because it's not about regulating pollutants while there's operation. It's actually about reducing the amount of operation at the regulated sources. So that's the big first category of argument, which is that generation shifting is not permissible as the best system of emission reduction under Section 111D. And the second of the four core legal arguments is whether something called the Section 112 exclusion prohibits the rule. And under Section 111D, it says that it can only be used for, and I quote, an existing source for any air pollutant which is not emitted from a source category which is regulated under Section 7412 of this title. 7412 is Section 112. This language, and I mention this now because it's important to one of EPA's arguments, dates back to the 1990 amendments to the Clean Air Act. So our contention is that this limitation in Section 111D, under its plain terms, is that you cannot have a 111D rule for a source category that is already regulated under Section 112. Section 112 is a separate part of the Clean Air Act that governs what were called under the statute hazardous pollutants. It's undisputed that there is a regulation governing coal-fired steam generating units under Section 112. And so our argument is, because that regulation exists, they cannot have a Section 111D rule for the same source category, sort of regardless of the content. So it's not even that it's generation shifting. Whatever they had come up with, it's not permissible. We rely on the plain text. We rely on the fact that Section 112 was expanded in 1990, the same time that this particular language was added to Section 111D, and on the fact that for 25 years since 1990, EPA has agreed that our reading of this exclusion is a, quote, literal, unquote, reading of the statute. EPA's response is that the Section 112 exclusion is ambiguous. They say that regulated under Section 112 is not clear. And so they argue that the exclusion only applies where there is both a regulation of that source category under Section 112 and also a regulation of the particular air pollutant under Section 112. And so their argument here is that they're just trying to regulate carbon dioxide from coal and natural gas fired steam generating units, and that but in contrast, the existing Section 112 regulation is one that does not apply to carbon dioxide. They also argue, and this gets pretty complicated, but that when the exclusion was added in 1990 or amended in 1990, Congress actually passed two competing amendments. So there's actually a House, one that originated in the House and one that originated in the Senate. And they say that only one of those was included in the code. Because there are these two that exist in the statutes at large, this creates an ambiguity that allows EPA to come up with a compromise. And then under their compromise reading of the exclusion, they are permitted to do what they are doing here. Our response is that these two amendments are different in kind. If you study legislative lawmaking, there are different kinds of amendments. It's in both the Senate drafting manual and in the House drafting manual. There are things called conforming amendments and there's things called substantive amendments. Substantive amendment changes substantively the law. A conforming amendment is what you might think of as cleanup amendments. They go through and after you've made a number of substantive amendments, sometimes you need to go back and change cross-references and update certain titles and things that were moved or paragraphs are deleted. Our argument is that one of these amendments, the one that's not included in the code, is a conforming amendment. The one that was included in the code is a substantive amendment. So even assuming that there is a conflict between the two, the substantive amendment trumps the conforming amendment. That's what has happened in case after case after case. We cite numerous examples of this happening before in our brief, and our argument is that if the ramifications of adopting EPA's view, that if you have a conflicting, so to speak, conforming and substantive amendment, that you then allow EPA or whatever agency it is to come up with a compromise reading, that the ramifications would be dramatic, that there are numerous times where this has happened and it would create significant disarray in terms of being able to rely on what's in the United States Code. The third of the four core legal arguments is the so-called state authority argument or remaining useful life argument under Section 111D. This is another statutory argument. Now, if you recall, I said there are two parts to Section 111, right? There, again, there's 111B that applies to new sources of a source category, and there's 111D that applies to existing sources of a source category. There's an important distinction between the two. 111B, which relates to new sources, it is EPA that is authorized by the statute to come up ultimately with the standard of emissions that governs how you regulate these pollutants. 111D, however, there's a division of authority between the states and EPA. EPA comes up with the best system of emission reduction, assuming they satisfy the statute. And then they come up with this emission guideline. They put that out in a rule, and it is the states that develop the standard of emission for how to comply with the emission guideline that EPA has promulgated. And so our argument is basically they've stepped on our authority as states. We contend that under the statute, under 111D, EPA is only allowed to come up with an emission guideline. They can't hold us precisely to that because that would amount to promulgating the ultimate standard of performance. And so, you know, they need to allow us to have some flexibility in terms of, you know, meeting that emission guideline and whether, and even whether individual sources will meet it. And there's a more nuanced sort of approach to this, which is under the statute, 111D actually specifically says that states need to be allowed to take into account the individual circumstances of particular facilities and the remaining useful life because of concerns about stranded capital investments. And so EPA has specifically said that states cannot take into account on an individual basis the remaining useful life of particular sources. So our argument is that they're just in flat out contravention of the statute. EPA argues that there's a whole bunch of flexibility, and you can sort of look at our reply brief for how we respond to that. The fourth core legal argument is a constitutional challenge, and there's two parts to it. One is the commandeering doctrine, one is the coercion doctrine. So for those who may not remember the don't live and breathe state and federal law, the commandeering doctrine says that essentially the federal government can't use the states as implements of federal policy. They can't force us to implement federal policy. So they have to provide us, you know, they can create incentives, and that's what's done on a lot of things called cooperative federalism regimes, where they say, the feds say, you can do this. If you don't do it, we will do it. We will preempt state law. And it's, quote, an incentive, unquote, for states to regulate in that space consistent with federal policy. But it's the Supreme Court has considered that not to be forcing us to implement federal policy. Well, our argument here is that both options here, whether it's the states promulgating a standard of performance or if we refuse to do it, the federal government stepping in to do it, both of those are forcing us to become implements of federal policy. Obviously, if we promulgate the standard of performance, then we are helping to implement federal policy. But on the flip side, on the other hand, if we refuse to do that and the federal government comes in and says, here is the standard of performance, here is how these emission limits must be met, our argument is that, as I mentioned a lot earlier, there's a lot of things involving intrastate energy generation that EPA just doesn't have the authority to do. We are the ones who control the licensing processes for utilities. And so there are a lot of local things that need to happen in order to keep the lights on that would be required to meet a federal plan that would still be using states as an implement of federal policy. So our argument is that there is commandeering because both choices would require us to act as implements of federal policy. And in fact, EPA has said that they will be relying on states to use their traditional functions to maintain electric generation reliability. And then finally, the coercion argument is that they are coercing us to implement federal policy because of with the sort of dramatic shifts in energy generation and the changes in the power sector that the rule calls for, we are going to have to cooperate in order to make sure that the lights stay on. And if we don't, then there will be all kinds of reliability problems. And our argument is that that is unconstitutionally coercive. So those are the four major core legal issues.
That is a sweeping and breathtaking explanation there. I appreciate that, Albert Lin. I take it, before we move on to the record-based issues, I take it that if the petitioners win on any of these four core legal issues, they win outright, or is it that clear that it's a victory on any one of the four is a victory for the plaintiffs?
Yeah, in a nutshell, yes. There's some nuance that's sort of not worth getting into, but yes, in a nutshell, yes.
Okay, that's so you don't have to win the day on each of those four arguments.
That's right. They are independent grounds for striking down the rule.
Very good. Now, you mentioned earlier the record-based issues. I wonder if you can walk us through those, and just a quick note to the audience, when we're at the end of that, we will be turning to the audience for questions. So record-based issues, if you would.
Yes, thank you, Dean. Yeah, and there are a number of record-based issues, and they're sort of even more sort of diverse than the core legal issues, but I think I should be able to walk through those a little bit more quickly. The record-based brief organizes them into five categories. There will be two of the five mini-arguments devoted to record-based issues. So not all of the record-based issues will be argued. Some of them are going to be combined into one mini-argument. Some of them are being submitted on the briefs. So the first of the five, which has its own argument pod, is notice and comment. The Clean Air Act, like the EPA, requires notice and comment. And our argument is that there were significant changes from the proposed version of the Clean Power Plan between the proposed version of the Clean Power Plan and the final version of the Clean Power Plan. We talk about a number of them. One of them is that at the proposed stage, what EPA had proposed was state-level emission goals that were calculated for each state based on each state's particular circumstances. When the final rule came out, they had gone to nationally uniform goals for individual electric generating units. And now they still have state goals that they can come up with, but it's just based on multiplying out the number for individual units by how many of those units you have in your state. So they fundamentally changed the approach to the emission guidelines that they've promulgated. So the question is, did we get enough notice of what they ultimately did in the final rule to have meaningfully commented on it? And our argument is no. EPA has a number of responses to this. One of them is that it satisfies, quote, the logical outgrowth doctrine, which is a doctrine of administrative law that says that, you know, if the final rule is a logical outgrowth of what was noticed in the original rule, then that's sufficient to satisfy the notice and comment requirement. We, of course, argue that's too different to satisfy the logical outgrowth argument. And they also argue that we haven't satisfied exhaustion. We haven't given the agency a sufficient opportunity to address this problem. The second of the five record-based issues is that the rule doesn't satisfy various statutory requirements. This will also be argued. This will be argued in the last of the five mini argument pods. And there's a number of aspects to this, but the biggest part of it is, if you remember from my quoting of Section 111D at the very beginning of the call, a best system of emission reduction must be adequately demonstrated in it, and the emission limitation that the agency calculates based on the hypothetical application of the best system must also be, quote, achievable, unquote. And there's DC Circuit case law on what adequate demonstration is and what achievability means. But basically, our point is that for a lot of different reasons, the best system of emission reduction that they have just doesn't work. It's neither adequately demonstrated nor achievable. The threshold argument is that they've never shown that this novel system of three building blocks actually works, that electricity, that there won't be reliability problems, that this can actually, the system can keep working. But even if you analyze each building block individually, you know, they haven't satisfied those statutory requirements of adequate demonstration and achievability. And, you know, we walk through a number of different problems with their analysis. A lot of them are just that, you know, the numbers that they've come up with are speculation. Don't take into account a lot of real world practical issues with how electricity generation works. The third of the five record-based issues is that the rule is arbitrary and capricious for a number of different reasons. This particular section of the brief is not going to be argued, and how you know that is if you pull up the order from the court setting forth the argument schedule, it actually says what parts of the briefs are going to be argued. And there's a couple of bases here. We say that they failed to consider certain kinds of zero or low emitting energy generation like nuclear power, hydroelectric power. They also have a cutoff that only gives states credit for renewable generation that was put in after a certain period in time. The cutoff is 2012, 2013. And so we say that's, you know, an arbitrary and capricious cutoff. The fourth of the five big categories of record-based issues is that the rule failed to consider important aspects of the problem, and that's sort of language taken from a famous administrative law case, State Farm, that says that it is, you know, arbitrary and capricious for a rule to fail to consider, for an agency to fail to consider important aspects of a problem. There's a number of points in there. Two of them that specifically have been highlighted for argument by the court are that, one, that there are limitations on renewable energy that we think the EPA did not adequately take into account, like the fact that wind only blows sometimes, but not always. Another is that their cost-benefit analysis in terms of the benefits of the rule versus how much it's going to cost is flawed for several different reasons. And then finally, the fifth of the five record-based arguments, which will also be argued, is that states have unique issues that the rule has ignored. And so, you know, there's again a couple different aspects to that. What's highlighted in the argument order are some of the arguments about how the baselines in these states that EPA didn't take into account things that were happening in the states in the year that they took as the baseline for carbon dioxide and then calculating the reductions. You know, in two states in particular, Wisconsin and Utah, there were, you know, things that were happening with sort of certain major energy generating units, and, you know, those were blips that, you know, weren't taken into account when EPA was calculating, you know, what these states have to do. Secondarily, there's unique geographic issues. One of the things we talk about in the brief is that in Utah, coal plants are located in mostly rural areas, whereas gas plants are located in mostly urban areas. And so at a minimum, you've got, you know, those two energy sources that are not purely fungible because you've got, at a minimum, transmission issues. You can't just shut off the coal plants and expect the gas plants to sort of take over the generation that you've lost from the coal plants for a lot of different reasons, but not the least of which is you got to be able to get the electricity from the natural gas plants to the people who used to be relying on coal-fired generation. So that's a quick and dirty run-through of the record-based issues without getting into a lot of the nitty-gritty about why we think we're right.
Well, once again, we're speaking with Albert Lin. Let's open it up to audience questions. A reminder as we do this that obviously this is a case in progress, so there are things that Mr. Lin can and cannot speak about. Feel free to ask your question. And uh, So once again, if you have a question, feel free to ask it. And Albert Lin, if it's something you can't answer, obviously, feel free to say so. So if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've still got about 20 minutes left for questions. Got quite a few people on the phone. Our lines are wide open. A reminder to our audience to check the Federal Society's website and monitor your emails for a schedule of upcoming teleforum conference calls. Let me see if I can get us started here with maybe just a question that interests me. I don't know if there's a clear answer to this or not, but you've mentioned that there's, you know, five different pods of arguments, 3 hours and 38 minutes, different issues in different pods. That seems like, a lot of logistics being sorted out there. I think you also mentioned that the chief judge is recused in this case. How does a court like this, come to that come to decide how much argument there's going to be and then how it's going to be divided and parsed and who's going to do the arguing and which issues are going to be set to the side and which issues are going to be really, really focused on? And does this scheme that they've set upon say anything to you about the case?
Sure. I'll sort of answer what I can. I mean, I think in terms of how they came up with this, I think the answer to that is in some way similar to the answer to that in almost every case, which is, of this kind of complexity, is they asked the parties to submit proposals. And so, each side submitted its own. We kind of independently, negotiation as happens in all cases, but we both, our side and EPA side, ended up submitting proposals that looked pretty similar in terms of structure. We had actually broken it down into six pods, and we had asked for more time and to do it over 2 days. They had broken it down into five pods that very much resemble the five pods that the court ended up adopting. So what they did was one of the things that we had broken out, which was the state authority argument, they had combined into the generation shifting argument, and that's what the court went with. But the EPA side had asked for less time, and they wanted to get all of the argument in on 1 day. We had each side proposed, the various counsel, both sides had proposed multiple counsel arguing in each pod, and the court largely went with what each side had asked for. Like I said, they ended up adopting the five pods that EPA had proposed and then kind of splitting the difference in terms of time. And so, I think I don't remember exactly how much EPA had asked for and how much we had asked for, but they came in somewhere in between. So, in terms of like how they ultimately made this decision, it's hard to say. I mean, the whole court that's sitting out at all nine judges, entered this order. So they all considered, I imagine that, they gave it a lot of serious thought in terms of what issues they wanted to hear about and how much time they thought should be devoted to this. I mean, they did specifically say, as did we, that, just because something is not being argued and only being submitted on the brief, so that is not a reflection of what they think of the merits of those arguments. And I think they tried to make this clear as well, should we really take anything from the amount of time? I mean, some of it is a reflection of the complexity of the issues. So, how much does it say? I mean, it's hard. I'm not sure, and I don't want to sort of get over my skis because it is a case in progress, but I think both sides would agree that it is a very complicated case with a lot of different issues, many of which would benefit from the ability for the individual judges to sort of draw out what they're interested in at argument. And so, I know that on our side, we certainly appreciate the opportunity to be able to, have the various representatives up there to be able to help the court out, hopefully to see things our way.
Once again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've still got time left for your questions. We've got just one question on the board, then our lines are wide open. Let's take our first call of the day.
Hi, my question is about the status of climate science, for example. I tried to identify this tropical hotspot that is really critical to the...
Caller, can you speak up? We're having difficulty hearing you. If you could just speak up.
Okay. Quickly, my question relates to whether or not in any way, shape, or form the status of the climate science will come up in any of the arguments, for example, in the cost-benefit analysis. I bring that up because of, you know, it's widely known among us, the folks that have been preparing and submitting briefs, amicus briefs, that, for example, the tropical hotspot that they count on, the most important of their three lines of evidence, is simply not supported by the empirical data. And I wondered, in any way, shape, or form, will climate science and that failure of the endangerment finding come up in any of the arguments that you're going to make?
The issue of climate science and the endangerment finding is not in among the issues. It's certainly not. It's not in the petitioner's main briefs, and it's not among the issues that have been identified for the court for argument. I think is the short answer to that question.
Yeah, will it come up at all in the cost-benefit analysis argument, that the cost-benefit analysis is not appropriate?
I can only sort of speak to what's in our briefs, and we do talk in the cost-benefit analysis about, I mean, there's a couple different arguments. One is that the Clean Air Act only speaks to domestic costs. One of them is that they took into account, they didn't take into account certain costs that are out there. But I'm not sure that it was, I don't think it was put in terms of climate science or the endangerment finding. So I think, in terms of argument, what will be argued is the various parts of the petitioner's brief that the court has identified as things that they're interested in hearing about.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
We've got one more question on the board. If you'd like to join the queue, you need to push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. For now, let's go to our next caller.
Yeah, Mr. Lynn, I wanted to ask you about counting noses or counting votes. You started out with 9 when the briefing schedule was set. Of course, Justice Scalia has passed, and Justice Roberts has apparently recused himself. You had 4 justices who voted against staying the rule. I would have to assume that those 4 justices will also vote to sustain the EPA's rulemaking authority in this area. Am I reading this correctly? Are you looking at a 4-3 court as you walk in the door?
So let me clarify first that the argument now is before the D.C. Circuit en banc, so we're not at the Supreme Court yet. The stay was adjudicated by the Supreme Court, but the merits of the case are still before the D.C. Circuit, which is the Federal Court of Appeals, one level down.
Okay, I misunderstood. Okay.
Right. So we have 9 judges, 9 of the 11 of the full D.C. Circuit are sitting on this. If this gets up, and when it gets up to the, if it does get up to the Supreme Court, then yes, I mean, right now it's an 8-justice court. Chief Justice Roberts is not recused, so far as I know. He did vote on the stay. And so you've got, after Justice Scalia's death, you've got 4 justices who voted for the stay and 4 who didn't. I've talked before about the meaning of that. People would say the conventional wisdom is the 4 who didn't vote for the stay might vote against us on the merits, but I think it's hard to predict that, because when you vote against a stay, it doesn't necessarily mean you disagree with the merits. It may just mean that you, as a judge, don't think that there is irreparable and impending harm that requires a stay of the rule while the case is being litigated. So beyond that, I sort of can't speculate further, but I think that's something important to keep in mind.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Our lines, once again, are wide open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got about 10 minutes left. Albert Lynn, you mentioned, I think, 9 judges on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in the en banc. Does that include judges on senior status there or not?
It does not. And so sometimes, just as a very high level, Sometimes an en banc court can include senior judges, and when that happens, it's because there has been a panel decision that is being reconsidered or considered en banc by the full court. In that case, if there was a senior judge on the panel, that judge can opt to sit on the en banc court. However, here, we never had a panel decision because the full court, sua sponte, decided to do this on their own and take the case en banc in the first instance. So it's we start with the 11 active members, and then we take out Chief Judge Garland, who has recused himself, as well as Judge Pillard, who has also recused herself.
Let me make a final call for questions here. Push the star button, then the pound button if you'd like to ask a question. While we're waiting to see if we get a final question, let me ask you a couple of procedural things that seem to me unusual. Maybe you can say how unusual they are. Maybe there's no real answer to this. But how unusual is it for a circuit court, or maybe the D.C. Circuit Court in particular, to go en banc at the outset on its own motion? You mentioned in your opening remarks that you were all prepared for a three-judge panel with Henderson, Rogers, and Srivastava, and then sort of got late notice that it was going to go en banc. That's one question. And the other question is, how unusual is it to get a Supreme Court stay in a case?
Sure. As to the first question, in terms of how unusual it is for something to go directly en banc, this was discussed quite a bit in the press when this first came out. I have not done any further research into it, but my understanding was that the last time something like this happened was in the Microsoft antitrust case. And I think there, and I'm now way ahead of myself because I don't remember, but I think what people had said was that there was actually a motion there for the case to go en banc. This is particularly unusual because it was on the court's own motion. I'll leave it to people to read into that whatever they will. In your second question, Dean, escapes me now. Oh, how unusual it is for the Supreme Court to issue a stay. In this particular case, very unusual because, to our knowledge, this is the first time that the Supreme Court issued a stay of an administrative rule that was still being challenged on the merits in the courts below. So to our knowledge, this is the first time this has happened.
Did they, in issuing the stay, I guess I said I'd ask a final question, but let me ask one more. Was the stay issued without an opinion, or did the court get into the sort of, I don't know if you call them reliance costs or investment costs or conversion costs that power plants would have to begin to undertake to comply with the rule?
No, it was a one paragraph, just pretty standard. They set forth the contours of how long the stay would be in place, which is the only reason why they needed that many words. That and the fact that the name of the rule is quite long, as most administrative rules are. And so the stay goes through the Supreme Court's consideration of a cert petition and the resolution of that petition, whether it's a denial of the petition or a grant, and then a consideration and resolution on the merits. But that's the extent of what they said.
I thought you were off the hook here, but we've got two questions suddenly on the board. Let me go to each of these callers before I give you the chance to respond, and then if we have time, you can respond to both, or you can pick one or decline. But let's hear from our next caller.
Hello. I wonder if you had any reaction to this. My own reading of this, and by the way, I think the Clean Power Plan is clearly unauthorized by the statute, so I'm biased. My own reaction is that if Chief Judge Garland and Judge Pillard had not recused themselves, then you'd look at the lineup of the D.C. Circuit en banc panel and you would say you're going to lose, okay, that our side, the good side, is going to lose, particularly because of Pillard and Garland. But now they're gone, so you've got nine judges and you look at the lineup and you've got five Democratic appointees and four Republicans, but all you need to get is one Democrat. And I think you could get Srinivasan or maybe a couple of others. Do you have any reaction to that?
Let me, Albert Lin, before you respond to that, if you want to respond, let's get this second question on the board since we've got just 5 minutes left, and then you can take your pick here. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, building on that last issue with respect to Supreme Court cert in the stay, with respect to how what the outside date would be for that stay to remain in effect on when they could act on the cert petition. I mean, if you are, as the previous caller here indicated, on the losing side potentially, then what and the, whenever that date is, that opinion is issued, how far out from that do you have to file your cert petition? And then once it is filed and disposed of, the question is whether or not they would be able to rescind the rule under a Trump administration, for instance, in the event that that there wasn't a straightforward challenge on the merits. So as to foreclose an actual adjudication to where the rule's withdrawn and the case is mooted.
Right. Okay, so I will demur on the first question. I don't think I should be getting into speculation about how I think judges are going to vote before I get before them. In terms of the timeline on a potential cert petition, under the Supreme Court's rules, you get 90 days from the judgment from which you're going to seek cert. So and the argument will be September 27th. You know, who knows how long it'll take them to decide this. And, you know, there's all kinds of different reasons why one might expect them to go more quickly or to go more slowly. I mean, at a minimum, right, there are nine judges who are going to have to figure out how they're going to vote, where they're going to write, how many opinions they're going to be. So once that happens, I mean, just assume for the sake of argument a couple months, two, three, 4 months, right, then we're right around Christmas. There will be 90 days from whoever loses can file. You can also, if you need more time, you can ask for up to 60 days under the rule. So it could be 150 days, could be 5 months from judgment before a cert petition is filed. And then there's the brief in opposition from the other side, which is 30 days from the filing docketing of the cert petition, and generally speaking, you can get 30 up to 60 days. So that could be another 3 months, and then it's generally not circulated for consideration by the court for another 2 to 3 weeks after that. So, you know, if everyone took the maximum amount of time, we could be talking, you know, 8-9 months before it's even up for the court's consideration. Things could obviously move a lot faster depending on, you know, who wins and who loses and what people's various interests are. In terms of, you know, what could the next president do, I'm not going to get into a lot of, because there's a lot of different things in terms of a rule and how you deal with a rule that's in place, a lot of administrative law questions that are involved with that. And I think that's probably a topic that's for a different day and a lot more time.
Well, Albert Lin, this is Dean Reuter. I want to thank you for your time. I know you are very busy and prep for this case. I certainly appreciate you taking the time with us today. Just a note to our audience, we will have another teleforum conference call on this same case, so check in with the website and monitor your emails for that. We'll also have an in-person program, a panel discussion on this case, September 13th here in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club. But as always, thanks to the audience for dialing in and for your questions. And another reminder for the audience to about the next scheduled telephone conference call, check the website and your emails. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.